Good. Well, thanks. Thanks, Doreen. It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation to come and to the Perimeter Institute for hosting us and the PF conference for flying me out. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here with you. Okay. So there's some overlap, at least in theme, between the talk I'm giving today and the one I gave last month when I was here previously, which that particular talk was explicitly focused on the quantum Bayesian proposals, which I think have been familiar to many of us here, our good friend Chris Hoops in the audience. I'm going to be talking about that again today, but first of all, I want to talk about some other ways of thinking about quantum mechanics, which connect with the quantum Bayesian proposal, but which are perhaps a little bit more traditional. I should say a word or two in explanation of my rather long title. You'll be glad to hear I left off the second subtitle. I'll tell you what that is in a minute. So this title for this talk was suggested to me. It was suggested to me before I even had the thought of what we were talk by a comment that Michel Bidbon made at a very nice conference I was at Le Trey in France in 2007, I think it was. And he was making a comment at the end of somebody else's talk in the discussion period. And I can't remember what that talk was on, and I can't really remember what the content of Michel's question was. But he began with the following phrase, which really gripped me.
But it was Michel.
It was Michel, that's I'm sure. And
the phrase that gripped me was that, well, if one begins with a consistent instrumentalist position, and that's that when he said that, but that's why I forgot all the rest of it, because that immediately tripped off in my mind. But well, what would such a position be? And he went on to say, for example, such as Perez's. And I thought, well, that doesn't sound good to me, because whenever I read Perez's textbook, you know, the 95, I think it is, textbook on quantum mechanics, great textbook though it be, the kind of instrumentalist philosophy of quantum mechanics that is in there was, you know, paradigmatic of the kind of approach to quantum mechanics that always struck me as being likely inconsistent. So I thought, well, I really need to go away and think about this again. If that's supposed to be a good, consistent formulation of an instrumentalist approach in quantum mechanics, then I'm clearly missing something. And so hence the main title of the talk. What would a consistent instrumentalist position about quantum mechanics really be? The subtitle is, well, of course, due to our old friend, Wigner's friend. And I feel somewhat sheepish to be talking about Wigner's friend in such an enlightened audience as here. I mean, surely we all think that Wigner's friend is really elementary thinking about quantum mechanics, a really basic introductory philosophy of quantum mechanics, like, which is just a measurement problem. Surely there's nothing new to be said about Wigner's friend. Well, I think there is something new to be said. Well, how new there, I don't know, to be said about Wigner's friend. For at least this reason, I keep getting confused about it. I find it remarkably easy to trip up when thinking about Wigner's friend, and particularly when thinking about it in the kind of regime of an instrumentalist approach to quantum mechanics like Perez's own, and indeed like the kind of approach where there's subtle differences, important differences, the kind of approach which Caves, Fuchs, and Sharp take, the quantum Bayesian view. So by the time we get to the end of the talk, I hope I've clarified how ultimately the quantum Bayesians and Perez ought to deal with the Wigner's friend phenomenon. And I don't think that's been said in a straight line before, at least not that I've ever seen. And I think ultimately we can conclude that there aren't any worries about Wigner's friend that are going to turn around and bite the quantum Bayesian proposal. And one might find that surprising, because I, for one, have often worried that there are difficulties here that one might need to face. The second subtitle, which I left off, was something like why Asher Perez probably didn't realize what he was getting into when he wrote a paper with Chris Fuchs in Physics Today in 2000. Because a core part of my argument is going to be that in that paper, I think I can locate that the thrust, this particular thrust I'm talking about in this paper, was due to Chris here. He forces Asher to sign up to a position which destroys the consistent instrumentalism which I'm going to claim can be provided for him. So I don't think he realized what he was getting into, specifically by moving to single case probabilities, because that kills it. That kills the consistent kind of story I'm going to tell you about, the kind of instrumentalism that I think Asher Perez might have wanted to endorse. Okay. final word by way of introduction, of course. What's this word instrumentalism? You know, some very familiar to philosophers of science in the audience, but perhaps not necessary to everyone. Instrumentalism as a general doctrine about, it's a general doctrine about the meaning of scientific terms. And for, you know, it's been periodically popular as the, occasionally popular in the history of science as a general conception of what scientific theories are. The idea is that for the instrumentalist, that scientific theories don't describe the contents of the world, or at least they don't describe the non-directly observable contents of the world. These theories only give us an instrument for, a means of dealing with the world, which provides us with claims about what the results of experiments will be. So on an instrumentalist view, the content of a scientific theory, of any mature scientific theory, will be very limited in terms of its descriptive aims. It will only be describing that which one can directly observe, that one which one can directly, really directly, flashes on the scintillation screen, clicks of the detector, that kind of stuff is going to be described in the theory. All of the rest of the terminology in the theory doesn't, strictly speaking, mean anything. Literally, these words are empty. They only feature as a kind of pattern, which is there to shuffle around the descriptive claims about the directly observable. So this is quite a radical, as it were, a semantic view about the meaning of scientific theories. Terms in a scientific theory don't generally describe the world by and large. They can only describe the directly observable world, and we, you know, take that to be quite a small component of the world that there actually is. Now, nowadays, that view isn't a terribly popular one as a general approach to the structure of scientific theories. There are a lot of things wrong with it. But nonetheless, one can periodically take this kind of approach in a local manner. Now, one needn't take it synoptic globally as a description of for all scientific theories. We might say, look, occasionally it's going to be the case that we have some theory which we don't take to be all of its terms to be directly describing, approximately getting something else about things in the world. But it really is only a kind of a calculus for allowing us to make prediction. And one would often be tempted to take that kind of view if you think that, you know, this is a kind of a temporary theory, this is a pro-tem business, we're going to keep working and eventually we'll end up with a full, realistic, fully descriptive theory. So one can sometimes be, as it were, a local instrumentalist when one has grounds to think that, look, I don't think that the terms in this theory I'm using really do centrally refer to things in the world, and they don't centrally tell me about how those things behave. They are just a means of organizing a descriptive apparatus about the results of measurement. And someone can be a local instrumentalist about some particular subject matter without having to be a global one. And our subject matter today is going to be quantum mechanics, of course, and so I'm interested in those who think that this is indeed the right kind of approach to take towards quantum mechanics, broadly speaking. Don't take the great bulk of the claims made by the theoretical apparatus of the theory directly to describe how the world is. Think of this only as a calculus for predicting the results of experiments. This kind of approach, of course, is very influential with the founding fathers of quantum mechanics, particularly with Bohr and Heisenberg. And for them, in some ways, it was seen as, a progressive epistemic doctrine. Nowadays, there's absolutely no way that one would recognize the general view of instrumentalism, restricting one's claims in an instrumentalist kind of way, as being a progressive epistemological doctrine. But nonetheless, one might say, look, there are sometimes theories to which it should be adopted. Perhaps quantum mechanics is one of them. Okay. Yeah.
If you'll forgive a physicist here. Would I be being instrumentalist if I looked at the ocean and said, I'm just going to talk about the waves on the ocean, even though I suspect that they're made up of atoms and molecules?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't have to take the step further and say, I'm not even going to talk about waves, I'm just going to say that something keeps smashing into me. It's okay to talk about effective phenomena in language that implies that they are things, but if I admit that there are component things, then I'm being an instrumentalist.
Yes, roughly speaking, that's right. So certain kinds of instrumentalists have wanted to make the further claim that actually all you ever have are something like sense data, the direct contents of one's experience. Okay. And so there you would say, no, there aren't even waves, there are only just sort of wave images in my head. But what one needn't take that view, and I'm not actually interested in people who go so far, like, you know, general positive perception reasons, I don't think there's any reason that there are no such thing as direct contents of experience in that kind of way.
And one just doesn't need to go there, basically, for the kind of thing we're interested in. Yeah, thanks. Okay. So, you know, I've intimated that I'm going to be talking about Asher Peretz's view, the view in his book. So I thought I'd just put out, give a quick quotation here to locate what we're talking about. These kinds of sentiments would be very familiar to many people. The essence of quantum theory is to provide a mathematical representation of states, that is, of preparation procedures, together with rules for computing the probabilities of the various outcomes of any tests. A test is more than the occurrence of an unpredictable event. To be interesting to physicists, these macroscopic events must be accompanied by theoretical interpretation. This interpretation must be partly classical. So we have the idea here that the essence of quantum theory, and he means, I think, not just this is a necessary condition, but really this is all there really is to quantum mechanics, is that we have a piece of mathematics, that's the state, we associate that with some system, we have rules about how that state's going to change, but really its cash value is in terms of what it's going to tell me about the classical level, the necessary classical level of clicks and flashes and so on and so forth in the laboratory. And that's all there is to quantum mechanics. It shouldn't be taken to be describing realistically some more fundamental world. So that bit there, as it were, just the instrumentalist bit on its own, that sounds okay, actually. We don't need to, I mean, one might not think that this is the approach to take towards quantum mechanics, but we don't seem to have any problems with consistency. What always started getting me anxious was this kind of claim. It's a very Borean claim. So he said we have the distinction between that which is just given a mathematical representation of the state, which just relates to the measuring results. Then we have the level of existence at which measuring results live, the classical level. That has to be that. Goes on to say, well, look, you may ask, why can't we describe that measuring instrument by quantum theory too? And now I begin to get really worried. We can. However, this only shifts the imaginary boundary between the quantum world, which is an abstract concept, and the mundane, tangible world of everyday. If we quantize the original classical instrument, we need another classical instrument to measure the first one and to record the permanent data that will remain available for us to study. Now, what makes me get really anxious about this kind of move is, what's happened to those previous robust existing classical level facts we had to begin with? We're suddenly moving the boundary at that which we take to be describable and sticking the previous measuring apparatus, they're supposed to be facts about how it behaved, whether it clicked, which light flashed, whether it was scintillation, something like that. Suddenly that stuff being pushed onto the just a representation of further measurement results. Suddenly it looks as if that concrete world, tangible world that we had there, has disappeared because we're now being instrumentalist about it. And now we begin to wonder, what's happened to this everyday world? Surely it needs to be out there. But it looks like if we shift what we treat as quantum as classical, then what we previously took to have determinate facts about it, those facts disappear. And this is surely a very uncomfortable way for our theory to be behaving. Specifically, if we think that in order to formulate our theory to begin with, we need to say, no, there is a level at which there are determinate goings on. However, I can always then shift my quantum classical divide and now what? Well, that looks like that level of determinate facts has disappeared. But surely we shouldn't be playing so fast and loose with reality. And how can it be consistent to say, well, on the one hand, yes, there are facts about the measuring devices, but on the other, well, we can just shift up and now it looks like there aren't any. So how could this be a kind of a consistent picture? That's what always has worried me about this kind of Peretz-style instrumentalism, which is, I think, a direct inheritance of the kind of thing Bohr was doing. And if you think back to Bohr's discussion with Einstein on the uncertainty relations, there's this very frustrating move he keeps making. At one point he treats the diaphragm as classical, and the next time he treats it as quantum mechanical. And by these kind of dodging around, it feels like, he manages to get around Einstein's objections. But you really want to say, well, look, just tell us what the facts are about the classical world out there and behaves nicely. And that's the classical stuff, and it isn't quantum weird and undescribable. Tell us about that. And then don't suddenly play, flip the other card and say, well, but all that stuff can be treated quantum mechanical too. And it seems a very uncomfortable position. Okay. So, here's what we're going to be doing in the rest of the talk. So first of all, I'm going to point out that there is a very straightforward way that one could have an honest, consistent instrumentalism. It's this kind of shifty instrumentalism that I'm particularly worried about. So I think there are two claims which go along with the honest, clear, and definitely consistent form of instrumentalism about the quantum state. And then we can play about with dropping either of those. The Perez-style approach drops one of them, and the quantum Bayesian approach drops both. Ultimately, I'm going to argue that that's okay. You can tell a consistent story in both of those cases. But one needs to, at least I need to, try and keep a really clear grip on exactly what's going on if one's to see that that is consistent. So in developing the claim that shifty instrumentalism about the quantum state can be made consistent, I'm going to emphasize, I'm calling here, the way of levels, a kind of rigor that one needs to apply to thinking about what level of descriptions one is using at any given time. And we'll identify the core problem, that core problem about what's happened to the world that previously looked as if it was determinate and out there and has suddenly gone quantum and waving. As I say, I think we can solve that core problem in the Perez-style instrumentalist approach. And I think we can solve it without really having to appeal to decoherence. And I'm going to suggest why that's so. And I'm also going to suggest that debates about the question of whether or not a given measurement process, because that's really what's always working in the back end, is reversible or not, aren't particularly helpful ways of approaching this kind of problematic about whether there are determinate facts about measuring outcomes. We naturally think in those terms, and when we're thinking about Wigner's friend, we often think in those kinds of terms, but I think it's they're not the best place to start off with. There are a few things that need to be separated out now. Then the final section, I'm going to talk about how we get from the Perez-style approach to the Fuchs quantum Bayesian cave Fuchs chart style approach, and talk in more detail about what happens to the story of Wigner's friend for the quantum Bayesian. Okay. Now, just to make sure we're all on the same page, our starting point in this instrumentalist setting, really that very first paragraph of Perez's, we have on the one hand those things that we're thinking of as quantum systems, some microsystem to begin with, call that there. That's, as it were, one level of reality. So S is the kind of thing that we think can't be directly described, or at least we're not going to be directly described, we're going to be instrumentalist about it. So if I assign it some state rho, some density operator rho, that state isn't going to be describing the properties that system intrinsically possesses, or extrinsically possesses. It's not going to be talking about its properties at all particularly in any kind of realistic way. All that thing, of course, is going to tell me about, all it's going to tell me about, is what happens when I stick this device into some measuring apparatus. And here we have the quantum side, where we're not describing things, we're just assigning them states, which are interpreted in terms of the results of measurements, some probability distribution over them, for a device, call it D1, at the classical level. Okay. So we're dividing the world up into, this is very familiar, we're dividing the world up into systems that we have to assign quantum states to. Those aren't being directly described. Our only grip on them is pretty much via the state we assign to them. The only meaning of the state is in terms of the probability it gives us the outcome of these measurements here. Let's suppose this is doing measurement in some, projective measurement in some basis, phi k. Okay. Now, okay, fine. So one way in which we can clearly play this kind of game, in which we have this cut between the quantum on the one side, not describing the classical, where there are determinate facts about what's going on with the device that we can state unproblematically. One way of dealing with this this setup is to say, well, we're just going to fix where this divide is. We're going to say it's just a fact about nature that there's some bunch of systems at some particular kind of length or mass scale or energy scale or whatever it is we choose, at which they're all on the quantum side, they all have to fall on this side. And everything on the other side, that's the classical level at which there are determinate facts. And so, as it were, we're not allowing the shiftiness there. We're saying this cut is fixed once and for all. And then we can see that the kind of problem that I was worrying about to begin with in the latter half of the Perez quote isn't going to arise, because we're fixing the cut, so there's no question of the world going fuzzy when we move the cut because leaving it there. The other standard component of what we call an honest approach for being instrumentalist in quantum mechanics is to say, well, okay, I've drawn a little blob here and I've called it S and I've given it a state rho. But really, when one thinks about what probabilities mean, what I'm going to mean by state rho, what I'm going to mean by these probability of getting out from chaos here. I'm going to be broadly speaking frequentist about probabilities. I'm going to say that all probability claims mean is a claim about what's going to happen in an infinite long run, so infinite repeated, an imaginary infinite repetition of experiments of this kind. So the important point of this for the instrumentalist is that the quantum state isn't going to describe individual systems at all. That's the crucial thing. It's only describing ensembles of systems. And the ensemble idea, of course, is that we have a fictional infinite number of copies of a given thing, to which we're going to approximate with some real finite number. Obvious advantages of this kind of approach is that because we're not talking about states of individual systems, we're not saying that this particular system I've got in my apparatus now, the state that I assigned to the particular system I've got in my apparatus now, that's only really telling me about what would happen to many copies of that if it were repeated over and over again. We don't have any problems with EPR and non-locality. Because all that happens in that kind of scenario, where we've prepared some systems in entangled states, separate them, do a measurement over here. Standard kind of worry is that do a measurement over here, well, that collapses the state over here. But if one says that, well, what happened when I actually did that measurement on that system over there, on that one physical system I had in my apparatus, what happened when I acted on it? Did anything happen over here? Well, we're going to say, well, I'm going to write down a state for over here, but that state doesn't correspond to any particular physical property of the individual system that's over there. It only corresponds to what you'd expect from measurement results on very many repeated instances of this whole run. So there just isn't anything which happens to an individual system when you do a measurement on it over here. So it's not the case that we have action of distance because there wasn't anything changing. You wrote down these different states, but all that means is that if you do this experiment and you compare the correlations, you'll find that these are non-factorizable. It doesn't tell you that there was any action of distance in this kind of scenario. So we gain one immediate advantage. I mean, note it's kind of a cheap advantage because you're precisely going quiet on all that stuff which one normally takes oneself to be interested in, namely the real properties that the microworld has. So in the standard EPR argument, what Einstein was thinking was that you have this system, well, he was taking this to be the standard at the time, you have this system which is real properties are described by this quantum state of the individual system. And thus, in that case, if I write down a new state over here, then there really has been a change to the properties. But if one backtracks and says that changes in the states don't correspond to properties for individual systems in that way, then we're not going to have problems with non-locality. Similarly, the whole measurement problem doesn't really arise in the same way. You set things up so the issue doesn't really arise. How do you think about the measurement problem arising? Well, we're saying what exactly happens when this device goes into this system. If we were to treat the whole caboodle quantum mechanically, then it seems very far from being the case that we get some determinate outcome over here, we just get a big entangled superposition. But of course you can't do that if you say, no, look, this cut here is fixed and determinate. You can't have entanglement between here and here, you can only have entanglement on this side. So the measurement problem just can't really get started in this approach. So we get those straightforward results, that if you take this kind of view, then a lot of the stuff we standardly worry about just doesn't arise. And for many, that's exactly why they like this kind of approach so much. I think that was very much the kind of advantage by Shapiro. Okay. Of course, another thing to notice about this honest approach is that by being so honest and saying that there is this once and for all cut, there's the question of where exactly does that come. In order to have precise formulations of the theory, one would actually need to say that it comes right there. And then you're open to empirical refutation. So you'll expect that at some point Anton Zeilinger will tell you that at this level we no longer get. You've said that there should be no superposition past this kind of level. I've shown you we've got superposition, so what you claimed is wrong. You've got the cut in the wrong place. I mean, that's not necessarily a killer of disadvantage, because you say, well, look, I got it wrong. Let's shift it up a little bit to see what goes on. So that's, as it were, making a succession of claims about where the determinate cut is. That's very different from saying, well, I can just sort of shift this about willy-nilly. But then you're always going to be free from refutation, whatever Anton Zeilinger does in his lab, because you always say, well, I always think you can treat the whole caboodle quantum mechanics just sort of as far up as you wish. That's an interesting distinction to make. This kind of view sticks its neck out so it can get things wrong to make a precise kind of claim. Okay. Now, when we move to shiftiness, of course, we drop condition B here, the fixing the classical quantum divide. And so the best way to formalize this is to say, to be explicit about, we're always going to introduce different levels of description. So this might be level one, where we say, well, I'm assigning this thing the quantum state, and this stuff over here, that's the classical level. We're leaving that okay. We're happy that there are determinant facts at that level. At level two, we're going to shift up a bit, and we're going to say, well, actually, now all this system S and device D1, they can all be quantum mechanical, treated quantum mechanically together. And then we have the cut, and then we're going to need some device D2, with respect to which we define the results of measurement outcomes on the total system here now of S tends to D1. And then there'll be some probability dispute about that. Okay. And we have to be quite disciplined about what we're doing here. If we're saying that the stuff on this side is quantum mechanical now, the only description at level two that we're allowed of this is in terms of the quantum state. Some state, omega state by S D1. But if the only description we have of that is in terms of the quantum state, yet the quantum state only tells us about probabilities of measurement outcomes with some other apparatus, then that's not really very much of a description at all. We're not treating these systems, including system D1, descriptively at all now. The facts, if any, that there should be about what actual classical indicator it's giving, this one here, those aren't captured over here, and nor should they be, because we're saying, this is on the quantum side now. On the quantum side, we assign states, and the only thing you do with states is they tell you about what's going to happen over here. And one then generalizes it, so you might keep going up and up and up. And at the nth level, we assign quantum states to everything at the n minus 1th level, and we only talk about properties at the nth level, at the higher one. So determinate classical level properties only at the nth level, quantum states for everything at n minus 1. So that's is that description clear to everyone? Of course, there's going to be a big hand waving this about exactly how one defines what these levels are, but that may or may not be interesting. I'm not sure how interesting it is. Whether there's going to be a bit unclear about how precisely defined that is. But we can operate with the idea that what's crucial is that if we're saying that at level two here, what makes this level two is that we're treating the whole thing here quantum mechanically. The cache value of that is that you should be able to probe, you should be able to do proper correlation experiments on these that will display in theory. That's going to be the crucial thing. Yeah, Bill.
Based on the rule of consistency between the two levels.
Yes, and that's exactly where we're going to be scratching our heads a little, whether that can be held. That's exactly right. And I locate that worry about consistency in this kind of way. Now we've got this sort of apparatus on the table. When we move up to the higher level here, the level two, what happens once we stuck this on the quantum side? So this determinant classical fact here, where's it gone? Why don't we have it in our description? Yeah. And indeed, I mean, if we really think, we think I can either describe it like this or I can describe it like this, it will be consistent together. So whatever truths there are here should be co-tenable
with whatever truths there are here. But look, if I treat this interaction in an expanded kind of way, so suppose this is in some superposition of these phi states, then we're going to end up over here with an entangled state for S and D1, familiar measurement problem stuff. With an entangled state. Okay. And then we go, but look, how that's okay, by the way. And then we say, well, look, how on earth, if I think there's actually a definite outcome here, I think this thing is really going K, the outcome K. How can I believe, how can I state that actually the whole is in an entangled state? The normal way you read an entangled state, of course, is precisely saying that you don't have any, as it were, properties defined singly for determinate properties for either side. It's really only the whole in the pure state which has its determinant property. So shouldn't it be the case that rather than being this entangled state, which is what L2 seems to dictate when we treat the interaction quantum mechanically, shouldn't we just be assigning some pure product state to these things post-measurement? How can this story be consistent, given I think there's a definite A over here. Surely when I move up a level, I shouldn't be describing it by this, I should be describing it by the product. So this, as it were, is of course just the measurement problem rearing its head again in this, even in this instrumentalist setting where one's trying to back away sufficiently that the problem doesn't arrive. It looks like it's forced itself back on it. But that kind of reasoning, suggestive and powerful as it is, isn't really right. And it's this sort of, in working this bit out, that I keep tripping up over and over again. It's so easy to think in this kind of way. If we have a definite outcome here, then when we treat them both quantum mechanically, then it must be the case that either we have just a pure product state here, or a convex combination of them fits a non-selective measurement. But that's such a powerful way that we normally think that. That's really what was always lying in the back of my disquiet with these kind of shifty instrumentalist approaches. But if we really pay attention to the way things have been set up, if we were very disciplined about what it means to have these level distinctions, then it turns out ultimately I think that those worries, the core problem, doesn't arise. And there are two crucial points to notice here. For the kind of instrumentalist I've been talking about so far, we'll come to the quantum Bayesian flavor in a bit. We don't have states for individual systems, properly speaking. When we assign a state to a system, that's really talking about a state for an ensemble of systems, because it's talking about probabilities for measurement results on an ensemble. That's crucial. And the second point is that we need to be very careful about exactly what inferences we draw from the existence of these classical level facts. We acknowledge their existence. I say L1 is a perfectly consistent and correct way of describing the world. It says, on the classical side, yep, some definite outcome here. However, what conclusions actually does that license us in drawing about level 2? One needs to be very careful. So the important point that one vouchsafes us is that when thinking about this kind of measurement interaction, what we certainly shouldn't say at level 2 is that the S after this measurement really ought to be in one of the states, phi k, and some of the indicator state k. We shouldn't be led from the, why is that, first of all? We'll come back to how it looks this in a moment. Why shouldn't we say this? Well, what we've written down here is actually a non-selective measurement procedure. Right? So we haven't yet put our experimentalist character over here, who might, on seeing outcome k, divide up the ensemble of systems into various different boxes, each of which would then be in the, so we'd have a sub-ensemble in phi 1, sub-ensemble in phi 2, and so on. That's what would happen if we had a selective procedure, and then we would say that the post-measurement state at L1 ought to be one of the pure states. But since we haven't done a selective procedure, in fact, the post-measurement state of S here should be given by it's the convex combination of, so rho of S post-measurement is just going to be the convex combination of the pure states like that. Why is that important? Well, there's a very obvious sense now in which we have consistency in one sense between level 1 and level 2. Because if this is the state at level 2, which indeed we should think it is, and if it's been a nice clean measurement, then looking at this, we're going to say, actually, the level 2 agrees that the state for S is just exactly this. So we have probabilistic consistency between the two levels. And that's kind of cheap, easy, and obvious. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. What's significant about it is what would happen if we weren't thinking in, as it were, these statistical terms about the meaning of the state. If we thought that really there were states associated, properly speaking, with individual systems, and the probabilities were really single case probabilities for what probabilities one would get on this system alone, then really we should be thinking that at the fundamental level of reality after this measurement procedure, even when we haven't bothered doing a selection, there's a fact about what particular state, phi k, this system is in. So in a sense, whilst this is an okay state to write down on any given run of the experiment, we'd actually admit that no, there's really the fact about which one of these IKs the state of this thing is really in. And then we would have a contradiction with what we've written down here, because this is precisely denying that. Now,
Do you believe there would be an inconsistency even if this... When you say state is really in, I just want to get the idea. Is there an ontological commitment there, or is it merely the fact that the probabilities of some measurement results would be...
The two aren't separate in this case because we're being surreptitiously objectivist about probabilities. So we're thinking there are facts about the world which determine single case probabilities and thus and so. So that's the kind of idea. And of course, that's what we're going to be dropping when we move over to the quantum Bayesian approach. And that's going to be a crucial difference. So we only,
properly speaking, get the consistency between these levels when we recognize that actually the post-measurement state is this one, the code for L1 is the non-selective convex combination. Then we have probabilistic consistency between two levels. That's kind of straightforward. The more subtle one, this is the one that we only have to think hard about to convince yourself, is that the existence of clicks at this level here, at level one, it doesn't entail that the level two state really ought to be in this product state or not. It doesn't entail that it should be in that product state, or that it should perhaps be in the convex combination, where we have, you know, the states for the measurement device too. Why not? Well, we need to attend carefully to the discipline of distinguishing the levels. At level L1, we say we are treating this device statically. On the quantum side, we're not speaking about determinate classical facts at all. And we're not assigning the quantum states to things on the basis of classical facts that we somehow think to be living at this level. The way we assign the state for these things is by looking at what the result of the measurement outcome was and then maybe doing some sub-selection procedure. That's the way you assign the state. So it's not that there's really some hidden classical facts here that determine what state this thing is going to be. The only significance of these determinate goings on at this level is to interpret our probabilities, as it were, to say that you'll get this outcome with a certain probability, you'll sort of get a certain relative frequency in the long run. Now, when we move to treating the device quantum mechanically, the same thing applies there. The only level of determinate classical facts that we're interested in when we move up a level are those which we need to define the probabilities. That's the only level at which classical determinate goings on have any significance. In defining, saying, yes, you've got a measurement device, it's out there, and it has determinate goings on, and when you look at it, you're going to be picking up, you're going to be responsive to, you're going to have knowledge of those determinate goings on. That's the only point at which classical level facts come in. They don't come in here. So it turns out, of course, that we believe that there are, when we jolly well ought to believe that there are classical level facts about this device having registered K. That's a determinate fact. It has to be, because it was, we're saying this is a perfectly good description of the world. But that's a fact that we are ignoring when we assign the states to this thing. And why are we allowed to ignore it? Well, how do the states for the quantum side get determined? It gets determined by the relationship to measurements at the higher level. So the only thing that determine what states we ought to think should be applied to this is whatever states for the joint system we started with and whatever unitary evolution we applied to that, followed by whatever we then do at the classical level, measuring that outcome sub-selection procedure. Now, despite that, so that's what I call being disciplined about the levels. We don't think there are any classical level facts about this, because this is the stuff that we always think there's no determinate properties for the individual systems here, because that's the level at which you have to treat quantum mechanically. With these measuring devices, it's optional to treat them quantum mechanically. You know, the measuring devices, they do have determinate facts about them, but we can treat them quantum mechanically. We don't have to, but we can. So we are, properly speaking, allowed to ignore the fact that there's a determinate fact about that what that outcome was. So that's to say that, as it were, there's no shift in the ontological status of the measurement device when we shift where we put the quantum classical divine. You don't change anything about this system when we assign it this state rather than treating it at this previous level as something which, to which quantum state points. There's no change there. One of the reasons I think we find it so difficult, I find it so difficult to operate consistently with that thought, is the power of a very familiar kind of idea which we're brought up with when we talk quantum mechanics and which philosophers have given a name to, and that's the eigenstate-eigenvalue link. This is the idea that you have a definite value of some physical quantity if and only if your system is in an eigenstate of that quantity. Right? If you buy that, then game over for these guys, because there's a determinate property here. That happens only if you're in a particular eigenstate. So this would have to be in a k-eigenstate and not in an entanglement. But whoever said that our shifting instrumentalists ever had to sign up to the eigenstate-eigenvalue? Why ever should they? They're not in the business of reading off physical properties from quantum states. They're in the business of reading off probabilities for a higher-level measurement outcome from quantum states. So what trips me up, may have tripped you up, may not, is this idea that because we have a determinate outcome here, we need to assign either this state or the convex combination. But in reality, we don't. And the thought that we do is really, I think, being driven by this textbook eigenstate eigenvalue link idea. Okay. How are we doing for time? I should probably speed up. So we can get a consistency for the Perrow-style picture, so long as we're disciplined about what it means to treat things at a given level of description. If you include a classical device in the quantum description, then whatever facts there are about it, classical goings-on, aren't relevant to the state that it ought to have. The only thing which determines that is the relation to the classical devices at the higher level. The other crucial point is the idea that there aren't objective quantum states for single systems. In the Perrow style, we say, well, there are objective quantum states, but they're for ensembles. If you drop either of those components, then this isn't a consistent picture, it's just junk. So you might say, look, consistency is a pretty minimal requirement in an approach. If it's not consistent, then bin it. But that doesn't mean that if it is consistent, you should adopt it. So one might worry that this kind of looks as if it's ad hoc. So why are we playing this game of allowing ourselves to shift the splits around like this? Isn't this just an artificial way of getting around what would otherwise be a killer objection of inconsistency? And you might say, look, it's a kind of a messy approach, because it's not really clear how we should think of a second level or an nth level measuring device compared to an n minus one level measuring device. This is, if you think about what's going on in the lab, these things could actually look almost identical, and this doesn't look like a very physical kind of difference between these things. And it seems pretty clear that we're failing Bell's criteria for what a satisfactory formulation of quantum mechanics should be. You know, he thinks that after 60 years, he said, we should have a formulation of quantum mechanics which is precise and doesn't advert to measuring imprecisely defined measuring devices and so on and so forth. Clearly, we're not hitting Bell's criteria. Why might one like those kind of criteria? Well, a natural thought about what we strive for in a general physical theorizing is a joined-up, comprehensive, complete picture of how the world is. We like theories which treat everything all at once, all in one go, and just give you a god's eye view on everything. What we have here is, well, if I can stick at this level and I can describe these systems and give you predictions about what measurement outcomes will be. But suppose I get worried and I think, well, look, I'm actually kind of interested in the subtlety of what goes on in a system-device interaction. And in particular, I'm quite keen on seeing these kinds of correlation effects at a higher level. That's more detail about what there is in the world. It's going to be a fact that if you do a joint measurement on these pair, you're going to get that non-factorizable probability distribution. And that's a fact about the world. So shouldn't we go in our physical theorizing for something which gives us all the most detailed facts about the physical world all in one go? What we have in this kind of approach is that it's true that you can always, if you think, well, look, if I just start here, there's something I'm missing. I'm missing the details of the dynamics between here and here. So I can go to here. Now I've got the detail of that binary, that feather. But oh look, of course I'm missing the details of this binary. So it's whenever one sees a gap that one's anxious by, the thought is, well, you can always fill that gap, but only by opening up another one. And you might say, look, we'd like to treat everything all at once at the highest level of detail possible. So those are reasons why many might find this kind of approach still objectionable. On the other hand, a proponent of this approach might say, well, okay, what are you going to tell me about non-locality, and what are you going to tell me about the measurement problem now? Because that might occur for these other people. So, for example, they don't like hidden variables, and they don't like collapse theory, or whatever. So, you know, you pay your money and you take the choice. I just wanted to flag up some of those. So this, in some ways, is the kind of picture which I think, the philosophical picture that goes along with this kind of approach to quantum mechanics. There is a level of classical macro facts. Those aren't treated by the theory, except for the minimal sense in which the theory specifies probabilities for those particular subset of classical macro level facts, which are, in fact, measurement device reading. The guts of the theory is correlating macro preparations and observations, you know, correlate those determinate facts together by means of these mathematical objects, the states which are assigned to the microsystem. This kind of approach is going to be intrinsically approximate in its application. It's always going to be facets of the interaction between the system and the device which aren't dealt with. We're always going to have a lack of predictive completeness. There's always something else one could go and say. There's a further level up you could push things. And that's not an optional part of this picture. It has to be thus if we're to give any meaning to the quantum states we're assigning. There always needs to be this classical level, which is left bank. I've been ignoring any talk of decoherence, of course, and many people, when looking at the measurement of action business, are going to be saying, it's important decoherence does the job. Why have I managed to get by without it? Well, Perez doesn't think one can get by without it. In fact, for him, it seemed to be the main part of the approach that's going to solve the kind of consistency problems that I've been trying to convince you are there in the prima facie. So the internal consistency of the theory will simply mean that if an instrument is quantized and observed by another instrument, due to Stuckemore remain classical, the result obtained by the second instrument must agree with the result that was registered by the first. Okay, that sounds straightforward. And we ought to agree with that. Then he goes on to say something which is, whose relation to the foregoing is unclear to me. He says, more precisely, the probability for obtaining prescription results must be arbitrarily low. This requirement imposes conditions on what can legitimately be called a measuring apparatus. It will be shown that an apparatus must have enough degrees of freedom to behave irreversibly in a thermodynamic sense. This will establish the consistency of our approach. So here he seems to be saying what's going to render make the consistency is decoherence, effectively. We're going to have a large number of degrees of freedom. So we're not going to be able to see the fact that these fellows are entangled at this level. We're not going to be able to see it. Later on in the book, he says, the result is definite, the result of the measurement is definite, and cannot be affected by reconsidering the measuring apparatus as a quantum object. That's so. Measurements are conclusive only if there are no super observers, that is, if the interaction processes are de facto irreversible. Again, this is decoherence. But that seems to me to be missing the point. What decoherence is going to tell you is that, by and large, in realistic measuring situations, we're going to know that we're not actually missing much if we don't bother going on to analyze the system apparatus, the n minus one level system apparatus interaction quantum mechanics. Why do we know that? Because we know that it's going to be awfully difficult to produce an experiment which will pick up the difference between, that will display the kinds of subtle detail in the probability distribution which we're missing. So it's telling us, look, you don't need to bother actually typically shifting up and treating a quantum classical divide. You only need to do it for certain special purposes. But that's a very different claim from saying that when you have decoherence, you get a determinate result created. Now, what I've suggested is the right way of thinking about it is to say that the determinate results are all already there, quite irrespective of whether or not decoherence got. So it's not the case that the thing is conclusive only if there are no super observers. That seems to me quite wrong. The result's conclusive if it's conclusive. If the thing got as a measuring device, then it went click, right? And that's a fact which we're not treating itself quantum mechanically. It's just a fact about this thing, it's a fact about this thing. So decoherence isn't playing a key role here, although it makes our lives a lot easier, is the thought. The other thing is, well, how the issue of reversibility is going to play out here. How are we gonna, you know, is this measurement interaction between the system and the device a reversible one or not? Well, I think that's a badly posed question in this session. If we're to talk sensibly about whether or not something's reversible, then we need to have some dynamics that we're talking about. Is the dynamics reversible or irreversible? And then, you know, properly speaking, you only have dynamics defined, certainly only quantum dynamics for stuff we're treating at the quantum level. And then it will say, well, is what I'm looking at a reversible process or not? Well, it depends on whether you're treating it at a level at which it's quantum mechanical or not. So we just can't answer the question of whether the measurement process is really reversible. We can say at level one, you know, this interaction, because it was a quantum classical one, well, that wasn't a reversible interaction. But no more is it an interaction we have any kind of description of at all. You know, that's part of the story that we have to be silent on. Move up a level. Well, now this interaction, that's clearly reversible. Look at the evolution that we see. But now, you know, this interaction between these and this one, that's not going to be reversible. But again, that's not something that we have a dynamics for at all. That's not really something, strictly speaking, about which the question of reversibility or reversibility can be posed. So I think it's we can get badly tripped up with the issue of reversibility if we don't pay attention to the fact that it only makes sense to ask as a level relative question. Right. We're nearly at the end now. We shall move smartly from, I suppose, the Chris Beek. So in the 2000 paper, the slightly mischievous in intention, I think, 2000 paper in Physics Today, there's a big shift. You might not notice it unless you've sort of read carefully the Perez book and his previous works and then read Chris's stuff and then looked at this paper. The big shift is that whilst in his book Perez is explicitly frequentist about probabilities, in this paper there's a sudden move to talking about objective single case probabilities. That's very sensible. Frequentism is an absolutely hopeless theory of probability, completely useless. Why do we care about probability? We care about probability because it needs to tell us how we ought to behave if we're going to be rational agents, right? And I need to know what I need to do in the next situation that I face uncertainty with respect to. There's no good telling me how things will turn out in an infinite long run of instances. And it's not just that I'm not old enough and I'm not going to live long enough to go through an infinite sequence. It's that you can never future end. That's the point of it being infinite. So any finite run of outcomes is consistent with probability, with the probability that you assign if you believe in terms of frequency. So frequentism is absolutely hopeless. We need probabilities to be a guide to our lives. That, in fact, I think is how we actually get a grip on the notion of probability at all. And if you believe in objective probabilities, you think that you get a grip on the notion of objective probability via what's sometimes called the principle, the thought that if I knew what the objective chances were, then I ought to have certain degrees of expectation about what I see. It's in that kind of interaction between the physical facts there are that might be around and how I ought to behave that one finds the real grip for the notion of probability. Anyway, so it was right to move to single case probability and to drop cause A in what I've called the previous honest, straightforward kind of instrumentalism. But thereby hang dangers. And of course the danger then is that suppose we keep, I doubt that Asher Perez would have wanted to follow Chris all the way down the subjective single case probabilities that he's been led to. He'd have wanted to keep the objectivity, and it's a fact that if the state is thus, then the probabilities are thus. It's now just, this is a state for an individual system. Immediately we run into difficulties. Of course, what's going to happen in an EPR case? Well, now when I do a measurement over here, there's going to be a change in the facts about what the single case objective probabilities for Bobside are. That's a real change, the physical fact made at a distance. That's actually a distance. In terms of our consistency picture here, we're in trouble now because when we do this measurement, if we get on a single run outcome K, that means that I really do think that this system should be in particular pure state phi K. And that's different from the claim that would be made in this entangled state. Because if you think that this state now gives us the objective single case probability, I'm going to say there's some there could be some weight for outcomes which are given zero weight by this one. They're going to disagree on what the objective probabilities are. If you have disagreement, you don't have consistency anymore. So by making one move in the right direction, by dropping frequentism, I think Chris dropped his friend in it a little bit with his philosophy of quantum mechanics, because it kills the consistent picture that we saw before for our levels instrumentalist as well. So that's problematic. The way Chris responded is by saying, well, look, anyway, I don't believe in objective probabilities at all. I want to purely take probabilities to be degrees of belief and only degrees of belief, and that what degrees of belief I have, that's just a fact about me. It's not determined by any external facts about the world. My degrees of belief aren't and oughtn't to be responsive to any kind of physical fact out there about what state the system's in. States, that's to say, are just my degrees of belief about what will happen when I do a particular kind of measurement direction. Then, of course, we don't have a problem about consistency anymore, because if you assign different probabilities, if different agents assign different probabilities to things, it's not that they're disagreeing on any facts about that are out there in the world, they're just expressing different degrees of belief about what they'll see on the result of measurement interaction. So that's how Chris got out of this kind of trouble. I doubt it would be a route that Asher Peres would have liked to follow, given his commitment to objective probability. This leads us to close for how the story about Wigner's friend is going to look for the quantum Bayesian. Wigner's friend, of course, has been lurking around here the whole while as an example of the kind of situation we've been looking at. So just to remind anyone who may momentarily have forgotten what the story is of Wigner's friend. We have the lab, we have some lab bench. In the lab, I think this is doing some kind of optics experiment or something. We have Wigner's friend here in the lab. We have some measuring device here. And out here we have Wigner. Because he's a theorist, so he doesn't need to get his hands dirty, so he can look a bit dapper. Right, so the normal kind of story about Wigner's friend is, okay, look, he's doing an interferometry experiment. Then there's some interaction with a measuring device, which starts from some ready state, and then something happens. And the question is, what does happen? Well, Wigner on the outside says, closed physical system, just going to treat it as normal, purely unitary interaction, you go to an entangled state. Friend on the inside, of course, says, no, I can see stuff happening. These detectors for me are detectors, they fit. So I'm going to say that, no, in fact, after the result of measurement was, the result of measurement is that, say, it goes to the state zero, whereas he would say it's zero plus. Okay, that's a normal kind of story. Now, the immediate thing to say for the this is just another way of reformulating the standard measurement problem. The immediate thing to say for the quantum Bayesian about this is that I have no fear of this situation. What kind of disagreement is this? It's a disagreement about quantum state. Well, that's no kind of disagreement about anything in the world at all. So it's quite consistent for me, Wigner, on the outside, to assign an entangled state. True, I may differ in the subtleties of the probabilities, the single-case probabilities that I'm going to assign to goings-on in the lab for my friend. But since probabilities aren't responsive to facts in the world, that's not a disagreement about facts in the world. It's unproblematic. In some respects, that's a perfectly adequate answer. It's the answer that I tend to give when outlining this kind of view. But I think ultimately it's not sufficiently articulated for complete conviction. Let me see what else have I said here. Yeah, so that's the kind of cheat move. Fundamentally, it's right. It means that there's a sense in which it's going to be very hard to catch the quantum Bayesian out precisely because of their subjectivity about probabilities. You're not going to be able to show them by wrong by doing any particular experiment because there isn't the right kind of link between the subjective probabilities and experiment that would show a real inconsistency. Nonetheless, even if one takes that line, I think there's a residual worry about the status of the measurement clip. Was it the case that friend in the lab saw detector one go click, or did he see it? The other one go click. You know. Is it the case that there's a fact about that, or not? It's all very well saying that, okay, they've got different probabilities, but tell me about what the status, the ontological status of the click is. And the worry, sort of a general worry for the worry that I still have for the quantum Bayesian here is that if you think there's a definite fact in the lab about whether the device went click, then doesn't that count as a kind of a constraint on Wigner's degrees of belief outside, the kind of constraint that is of the sort that one thinks there shouldn't be for the quantum Bayesian? So my thought was that if we think that there is a fact about whether the device went click, then really Wigner has no option. He can't describe this. He ought to describe this. He ought to describe this as an entangled state. He really ought to describe the operation as a, from his point of view, as a non-selective measurement procedure. Now, one could try and get around that problem by going soft on the ontological status of the click. And I worry that sometimes Chris and Rudiger are tempted in this direction when they talk about, well, it's only ever, what's important is the experiences I expect, and there are only ever experiences for me. To me, that sails too close to the arena of solipsism and idealism. And I want to be pretty much metaphysically a straightforward realist. It's just a fact whether or not the device went click. What we need to do is actually just deploy, and maybe this is obvious given what we've been doing with the previous Perez-style shifting approach. We need to disentangle two differences that I think are getting mixed up in the thinking about Wigner-Spend thing. So we tend to fixate on the fact that there's a difference in epistemic situation between Wigner and his friend. Wigner's outside the lab, he can't see what's inside it, but he can't see whether there's a click or not. I think there's a tendency, there certainly was for me, a tendency to muddle up that difference between epistemic situation and the question of what gets treated as quantum and what gets treated as classical. So one thinks that, well, because Wigner's outside and can't see what's in the lab, doesn't know what happened, thus he should assign the entangled state. A friend in the lab sees the outcome, so thus he should assign the pure state. But actually, when it comes to deciding whether or not what one's going to say about the detector, the pertinent question isn't, can I at present have epistemic connection to it, but am I treating it as quantum mechanical or not? Because it's perfectly consistent for a friend in the lab to say, yes, I'm going to treat the stuff on my optic bench and that's a genuine this quantum stuff, going to keep it superposed. There's no call on me to treat my measuring device as quantum mechanical. I can leave that classical. And that's exactly the same thing as what Wigner can do. He can do exactly the same. Well, I'm outside the lab. I'm not going to see what the result is. Nonetheless, that doesn't stop me treating the measuring devices as classical. And then what Wigner and Penn say is going to be very similar. They're both going to say, as it were, at level one, this is an irreversible process. There's before friend looks, it's going to be a non-selective combination of pure states. He's going to think the same as friend. Friend then also has the option of doing a selection on the state, which Wigner doesn't. But that's not a very big difference. Alternatively, both friend and Wigner can treat all of this bit, device included, as quantum mechanical. And then friend is, as it were, not going to pay attention to the fact that there are determinate classical level facts about his devices. He's going to keep his eyes closed, look the other way. Think of it, do in his head the Hamilton involution here. Think, right, now this thing's in an entangled state, I'll just have a quick peek and see what the, I'll use myself as the measuring device now. And again, Wigner can do the same. The only difference between them at all, really, is that Wigner would have a point where his friend wouldn't in treating himself, treating friend as quantum mechanical. But that's not really a significant difference. So again, the take-home message here is that the fact that there are classical level facts about the outcomes of measurement doesn't constrain tightly what state ought to be applied and whether you ought or not treat the device as classical or as quantum. Okay. Right. So to conclude, I think we can have a consistent instrumentalist view of the quantum state, which either drops condition B about having a fixed cut, or drops the view which says that these must be frequentist conceptions of the state, the probabilities, or you can do both, and that, dropping both is a quantum basis. Crucially, we get consistency when there are no objective states for individual systems. That happens in two ways, in the ways we've been discussing. In the Perez kind of view, it happens because one is talking about ensembles, so not of individual states. In the quantum Bayesian view, it's one goes soft on the objectivity, so actually that there are states for individual systems, but they're fully subjective. And the crucial point, the other crucial point is that the existence of macro-level facts has no direct implications for the quantum states assigned to the classical level, stuff that could be treated classically, and conversely. So Wigner's friend is ultimately no problem for the quantum Bayesians, and the question of whether or not a process is reversible, and the question of whether or not there exist macro facts about the outcomes of measurements, are just separate questions. One's a level-dependent question, that's so both in the Perez style and in the quantum Bayesian style. But how reversibility relates to the level of macro facts, so there is no strict linking between them. These are just separate questions. Okay, I'll stop there. Sorry to have gone on so long.
I'm happy to. So that's Howard and Bill.
So I just wanted to address this last point, or maybe more a little worry I had about the way structure of his friend. It may be related to this last point, or it may really not be an important point. But it seemed to me like you made an assertion that Wigner and his friend can both treat the apparatus and the system being measured within the lab as quantum.
Yeah.
And I just worry that that may not, in fact, be physically true for most experiments because of decoherence. And, you know, does
sort of.
I feel like somehow that is linking this reversibility and macro facts back together.
So I agree with the first, but not the second. So yes, I mean the reason why it's natural for Wigner but not for Friend to treat the apparatus quantum mechanically in that case is because there's a box between Wigner and the stuff. So how do we interpret the box? We take it as no causal interaction for at least some period of time of interest. There's no causal interaction between the contents of this and this. So that makes it natural for him to treat it as quantum mechanical. Because he's thinking that, because this constitutes a closed system, then I merely need to keep track of all the degrees of freedom in there.
So the box isn't the lab there.
Well, it is the lab, and it's properly speaking, it's going to be a box, a porous box. So there is going to be, there are going to be causal leakages across pretty short timescales here. So it's a difference of degree, effectively, because, as I say, a friend could be sitting in the corner looking out the window with a cup of tea, rather than peering intensely at his detectors, waiting for them to go click. I think the general shape of that kind of worry relates to the idea of, well, I'm trying to get these guys off the hook, get Perez-style shifty instrumentalist off the hook by imposing this level discipline. But it's in realistic situations, it's going to be mucky how one does the level distinction. Now, as to how the decoherence business relates to the existence of macro facts, well, perhaps you can help me out, because that's precisely what Perez says, and I simply can't understand what he could have in mind. So if you can flesh out that thought, that would actually be very helpful for me. So why does it make any difference that I think that I'm not going to be able to track the detailed correlations to the question of whether or not I think there's a determinate fact about the state of the measuring device, the facts about it?
Well, I don't know. I guess it's more just that I have the feeling that maybe there is a physical distinction between, that actually allows us at some point to make this cut. And you know, that somehow the classical reality is really there, because at some point, it may not even be decoherence, except that decoherence gives you an idea how you see this popping up, even within quantum mechanics. At some point, you just can't do the interference experiment. And that becomes especially obvious when you think about the state vector of the universe. Right? And then, so if we say, well, the state vector of the universe is absurd because we aren't going to be doing experiments on the whole universe, maybe it's not to take the state vector of our local bubble, people like some cosmologists. I don't know. But if somehow there's not even any thought experiment you can imagine that would help you give any meaning to the state vector of this stuff, then at that point you...
That seems to me more to speak to the idea of don't get too worried about trying to do a dynamical, that is to say a quantum analysis of interaction between measuring device and system. Because, you know, in principle, you're never going to be able to really get something which is going to be able to probe significantly this, to these correlations. So that's saying, you know, so there is a pragmatic level at which you're not going to bother shifting, even for the shifty instrumentalists. But for them, I think it's going to just be a pragmatic factor that there's a certain level beyond which I don't need to bother, because it's so hard to, and you know, the instrumentalist view is roughly speaking pragmatic. You know, you want to be able to influence what's going on in the world. If it'd be impossible to keep track of the detail of the non-factorizable probabilities, then you know, why bother shifting? But that's a different thing from saying that there's one level at which there are determinate classical facts and at another there aren't. Now, again, in the eigenstate eigenvector picture, the eigenstate eigen... Sorry. Eigenvalue
eigenvector. Oh,
that's... Yeah, that's the one. Sorry. In that kind of picture, what one tends to say is that decoherence is clearly not sufficient for determinateness of an outcome, because it doesn't matter that I can't tell that I can't practically distinguish a proper from improper mixture. What I really care about is whether the facts exist, and the facts exist only if there really is a state for this thing. But you know, we're not playing that kind of game here. So the question is how. I'll leave it at that. I think so. I'm unconvinced. I guess.
I don't know if I can formulate this with sufficient clarity, but the picture of levels in terms of measurement might be made clearer if you think of it not in terms of system measurement interactions, but if you were to conceptualize it in terms of those systems in the first instance, microsystems that exhibit this strange probabilistic behavior, and systems of greater complexity of such microsystems, which to all intents and purposes don't exhibit that behavior, otherwise we would have noticed it long ago. And the conceptual problem with which you're dealing is how to understand the application of a theory with the peculiar probabilistic features of quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And that that problem is somewhat different from the physics of what happens if you put a lot of these small things together and get something physically more complicated, which in terms of some physical understanding would tell you one perhaps could expect to have to make the conceptual proposal that you've done of just looking at how the conceptual proposal of looking at how these systems exhibit the outcomes that they do without necessarily attributing any definite properties to them. I don't know if I'm making that.
No, I've been dim. I haven't followed. So you wanted to contrast. What, on the one hand, we have a picture where we say, look, start with a microsystem. It has a non-classical probability structure.
Yeah.
And then I can imagine composing these, and there's, as it were, going to be a grand...
something like this table.
Yeah. So there's going to be a grand, non-classical probabilistic structure, which actually, if you coarse-grain a little, is going to look very much like a classical probabilistic structure.
Yeah.
Right, so that's one view. And then what's the other one you're comparing, you're composing it to?
I mean, there's a physical question of why it is that when you get a lot of these things together, you get the situation that manifests itself by the acceptability of a classical description of it. And that seems to me somewhat different and entirely another question from, and it may be a question where decoherence has a role to play. That seems altogether different from the conceptual issues that are posed by the probabilities that the theory exhibits, and which you...
I think perhaps I'm somewhat in agreement. I think perhaps maybe what you're saying isn't that far from what I'm trying to make the key point, which is this one, that the... there's one, as it were, saying that my point of decoherence is, as it were, it's in some sense irrelevant. So we are faced with facts about the behavior of macroscopic stuff. That's not up for grabs, that stuff's just out there. Now, it may well be that there's a story to be told, too, about why we typically don't need to bother about the non-classical nature of the underlying probabilities. That's the decoherent story. But that's just a different matter from the matter of whether or not there are determinate classical goings on. So that's how I'd be inclined to put it, and that seems to be somewhat consonant with what you were saying.
I think so. I have to think about it further, but I think that's in general. I mean, I want to make this shift between what it strikes me is a conceptual difficulty, which I think you are addressing in a very interesting way, and an issue that would legitimately interest the physics of the situation, but which has been thought to be essential to the clarification of the conceptual
issue. Okay, right,
and so I don't think that they're, I don't think it is. I think they're quite different.
I think that's
they're both legitimate problems, but they're different.
Yeah. I would agree with that then. So I'm putting in mind here of, of course, Jeff Boob has been writing similar kinds of viewpoints for a while, and Itamar Potowski too, wanting to distinguish small, big and small versions of the measurement problem, and the big one is supposed to be a pseudo problem. It's the question of how the determinate classical level goings on arise, or as it were, how do they get to be facts about the results of measurement. And the small one is how do we kill off interference terms in a way which means we don't get to see the quantum probabilities. And so perhaps there is a relation between that distinction, the one perhaps the same as the one you're making and what I wanted to make here. The point I want to add to that is that with Jeff and Itamar saying that, I've also been at the same time giving them a hard time about saying, well, if you're going to take that line, how does what you're saying differ from just straight out instrumentalism? That's the objection I had to Jeff's and Itamar's big small measurement problem distinction, that it seems to me to collapse into instrumentalism. So that would explain why there's consonance here, because it is an instrumentalist view which has that feature. Whereas Jeff and Itamar seem to want to hang on to some extent to something of a more realistic picture, without yet being a hidden variable interpretation, which is, I think, tough for them. I don't think
right. That. Right. Well, I don't want to take up all the time in the question period, but instrumentalism raises another, it's a complex issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be focused on interpreting the probabilistic aspects of the theory by seeing it as confining you just to the effects these systems have on the thing, mm-hmm. and not telling you their character, without being fundamentally instrumentalist, I don't think.
Well, not fundamentally, but it's clear that one's being instrumentalist in some sense. Right, there are things about which one is being instrumentalist. So similarly, with one of the objections that's often raised to Chris Fuchs's quantum Bayesian approach is, oh, look, this is just instrumentalism. And there's a sense in which, well, right, and that's conceded at the outset, but also wrong, because there's a whole other backstory that's going on about how we ought to think about the quantum world in which we're embedded,
right.
Which I take it for Chris is a kind of pitch where there are micro-level goings on, which I'm interested in. I think I'd really love to be able to find out about. It's just that the world's not playing ball anymore.
Right.
So the global picture is realist. We try and produce realist theories, find out the world's not playing ball, these are the fundamental elements to ill behave to miss the direct description that kind of way. So we're forced to adopting an instrumentalist approach to this particular mathematical formalism as a way of dealing with that stuff. That's very different from, as a kind of thing I think Bohr and Heisenberg sometimes did,
right.
Just to say, you know, instrumentalism is the right way of thinking about physics fundamentally. You know, we should only be trying to draw relations between directly observable to, you know, by the naked eye goings on. That's a bad move, but so that's consistent with being locally instrumentalist for specific reasons. Right?
Yeah.
Do we have any more?
But it could be more than the generalizability to all theories. It could just be that you take yourself to be restricted in this particular domain to what you can say. You can say things about the non-dynamical properties of these objects,
yeah.
And about their effects.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll just tell you a story about, maybe a lot of people know it, but Asher Peres would tell a story of how Jim Cushing came up to him once and said, "It's said that you're an instrumentalist, is it true?" And Asher said, "Yes." And Jim looked at him as if he were a cannibal. Apparently most instrumentalists don't admit it. That's right.
Well, at least he is familiar with the phrase, right? Which is.
You sort of reminded me of that when you said, well, I think Jeff is an instrumentalist, but he doesn't say that he is.
That's right. Well, he explicitly denies that he is, that's right. So he wants to have his cake and eat it. He wants to have all the benefits of being an instrumentalist without trying to be so cheap as an instrumentalist. That's
Chris?
Yeah.
Did Asher mean yes, I am, or yes, it's said?
Oh, yes, I am. He meant yes, I am.
You say it.
He often calls himself a hospitalist. And
also a form of cannibalism.
And he called himself a recalcitrant positivist. And he had lots of names like that for himself, but he wasn't ashamed of it at all.
I mean, one issue we haven't touched on is another kind of difficulty with this approach. It's something I mentioned when I talked back last month. It's one of the generic difficulties for instrumentalists is meeting the demand for explanation. So if you go very silent about how the little stuff that makes up the world actually behaves, then it suddenly becomes very difficult to actually come up with any substantive explanations of anything we're interested in. So this is the big stick with which one tends to hit the instrumentalist, why it doesn't seem at all satisfactory as a general view about science, because fundamentally, it's good to predict stuff, but really, like explanations, they make us feel good. And you can't really actually move on to significant levels of new detailed prediction without having a grip on the explanation about what's going on in the world. You can't even begin to think about what questions you might ask next. So I think there's a whole big issue that we haven't touched about, whether if one really did take the Perez line, made sure it was consistent by applying this kind of levels discipline I suggested. You're still not out of the woods yet. You face the question. We do seem to have a whole range of extremely detailed and substantive explanations about the micro goings on in the world coming from quantum mechanics. And you're really telling me that that's all just empty talk? It's just flapping mouths? Surely not. Surely not. This stuff is explanatory. So that's another kind of question. Maybe possible to finesse it if one came up with a sufficiently inspired theory of explanation, but theories of explanation are a tricky beast.
Like the bumper sticker I once saw in Los Alamos, which I'm not agreeing with. Nuclear weapons equals peace, 5 decades of experience. Instrumentalism equals explanation,
yeah.
Or at least implied.
Yeah.
Can't lead to explanation. 8 decades of experience.
Well, let's thank Chris. If you have more questions, we'll be around.
Well, thanks for listening, Chris.